like, goodness gracious, like, malaria has, I believe, has, like, killed more people than anything else in history, if I'm correct.
Can we just pause for 1 second? There's a seagull dancing on my ceiling, and I'm going to throw something
at it.
Sorry.
For the listener at home, if this makes it to the podcast, Caroline just threw, like, a rock or
something straight at a stick
of their roof, and just straight away.
This has clearly happened before.
Welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the podcast where we learn about everything and anything interesting. This episode we will be talking about a science topic, answering a question, and looking at a miscellaneous topic too. My name's Caroline, and this week's science topic is going to be all about the golden toad.
Oh!
It's me, so obviously I had to talk about amphibians at some point.
I know, it's been a while since you've talked about frogs.
It has, so, I've only talked about frogs two times, so I've got to get that number up a little
bit. In our very limited 12 episodes.
The Golden Toad is my favorite Brandon Sanderson novel. I don't know, I'm also fascinated that it sounds so magnificent.
It sounds so grand for what it is. Yeah.
We'll talk just entirely about this wonderful toad, I suppose.
That's a lot of information about a single animal, but.
Yeah, I'm really curious.
Or is it about multiple animals? We'll see.
Oh.
Ooh.
My name's Tom, and today's question is, how many human objects are on the moon?
I was worried you were going to say, how many human objects are there?
Are there?
And that was going to be too much for me to handle.
We can't deal with the object argument again.
No, I'm so glad this is the most, like, finite objective question I've ever asked. I am glad that, like, that's the reputation I have, that I would ask how many objects are there, but this is it's still tremendously interesting, but there is a number to this, which for anyone who is worried about that, there is.
My name is Ella, and today's miscellaneous topic is about a 4,000-year-old Mesopotamian bar joke.
I've heard of this. I don't know it, which I'm glad. So I'm excited to hear about it here.
I've heard it, and I've actually, like, heard it and read it a few times. So I'm very excited to learn a little bit more.
Oh,
about
yeah, we're gonna get into the research.
Oh.
If I'm not rolling on the floor laughing.
I think at this point we all know that I love amphibians, especially frogs and toads. I've talked about them at least twice on the podcast, as I said, but the golden toad is a pretty famous toad for a few reasons. So have either of you heard of it before? Tom, I know you have, just from the book title that you mentioned just now.
Oh, I was joking. I was joking. That it sounded like a...
So you've never heard of it?
A MacGuffin in a fantasy novel or some object of grandeur. Like, it sounds like a figurine that Indiana Jones would steal. Yeah,
that makes sense, yeah.
No.
And Ella, have you? No? Okay.
My knowledge on toads is exceptionally limited.
Interesting. So that does surprise me a little bit, because the golden toad is sort of it's a really, really famous toad. It's used in a lot of posters. I'll talk about that in a second. But basically, it's sort of like a figurehead of conservation, especially in Costa Rica. But we'll talk a little bit about the toad itself first, and then we'll talk about why it's important in a second. So they were found in an area called the Cloud Forest, just north of the city of Monteverde in Costa Rica. They're endemic to the area, which means that they can't be found anywhere else on the planet. Essentially, just on like three tiny little ponds in this cloud forest in Costa Rica. Each toad is about 4 to 6 centimeters long, so about 1.5 to 2.5 inches. They are
tiny.
They are teeny tiny. And during their breeding season, the males are insanely easy to find because they are really, really bright yellow. They're really, really beautiful. If you look at photos of them, like, they are stunning. You'll also see that the females are way less colourful They're more of an olive colour with like patches of yellow and orange on them.
All I will say about these pictures, they're very cute, they're very small, but there is one specific picture of a golden toad with an even smaller toad on its back. And this is like a toad which is maybe a sixth of the size of the golden toad, which means it must be minuscule.
Some toads are smaller than like your fingernails. Yeah,
that's amazing. Wow. And I want dozens of them.
Sadly, golden toads aren't as small and cute and adorable as that, but they are still pretty cool.
They're still pretty cute. It's a nice looking toad.
It is a very, it's a snazzy looking toad, isn't it? So they're pretty easy to find in the wild, at least the males are. And they usually, during their breeding season, they all hang out in the same place around these small ponds. The rest of the time, so they spend a few weeks of their lives outside of their burrows, but they spend the rest of the year in these tiny little burrows. So you can only really find them during their breeding season. These toads, despite how brightly coloured and beautiful they are, weren't discovered until 1964. So that's pretty recent, yeah.
I mean, I guess their area is very limited, so...
Right.
Their area was around 4 kilometres squared, was their habitat.
Wow!
It's tiny. So because of how small their area was, the Monteverde Cloud Forest Reserve was established to protect them. It was around 4 kilometres squared. It's now 100 kilometres squared, so the reserve has expanded, which is really, really cool.
Hell yeah. Soon the world!
But as I mentioned earlier, the species is really, really heavily featured on posters promoting biodiversity and conservation in Costa Rica. So especially in Costa Rica, the species is super well known. If you go to the reserve, you can actually see the WWF logo with the panda and a tiny little golden toad next to the panda. Aww. Which is really, really cute.
Aww. I apologize, the WWF?
The World Wrestling Federation.
God. Also known as the World Wildlife... Is it Federation? Foundation?
I think it's Foundation. Yeah.
Super well-known one. So, the species has never been huge in numbers. Around 1987, there were around 1,500 individuals, 1,500 individuals.
That's... fascinating.
There's not a load, but for such a teeny tiny area, that's quite a lot.
Mm.
And that sort of number had been observed every single year since their discovery. So that was a pretty standard number for them in 1987.
I just want to say this is so, like, strangely magical. I don't want to trivialize it, but it feels like in a video game when you, like, find a secret area, but then there's just, like, an entirely different species of animal that just sort of is here. I don't know. That feels,
well,
it's just wild.
Hold on to that thought for a second, because I might be about to ruin it a little bit.
No.
No.
So, 1987, 1,500 individuals. 1988, 10.
What?
Whoa!
1989, they found one.
No. Are they extinct?
And none have been seen since. Yes, they are an extinct species.
No. Caroline, what the fuck?
I'm sorry.
That's messed up.
There was hope for years and years after this species was last observed that they would be found again. Typically, the toad has a lifespan of 12 years. So any individuals that had bred during that 1987 period, where there were lots of them, they should still be alive. We waited and waited. It was declared extinct in 2004.
Oh, no.
Wow.
So, there's a question. What the fuck happened?
Yeah. That's my question.
That's the big one.
That's the question I had.
Uh-huh. Because that's a really massive decline. I think it was like a 90% decline and then a further 90% decline. And then, obviously, 1 to 0 is a further 100% decline in individuals. So, what happened?
Humans?
Well, humans is usually the answer.
I was going to say, that's kind of cheating.
I'll give you that, but do you, either of you have any other ideas about what might have happened to the toad?
Because it was, like, cordoned off, right? And
yeah.
It's not like it was
in the middle of a reserve, yeah.
Yeah, it's not like it was in the middle of Times Square or someplace, or where they were going to build, like, a parking lot.
Oh, so no one was actually going... Was someone secretly going there that shouldn't have been? No?
No.
That's a good guess.
That's a really good guess.
From our conservation stories, we've heard that is very possible. Mm-hmm. That's a likely scenario. Is it going to be an invasive species thing that happens?
Oh, you're, like, pretty... You're kind of close with that. Yeah.
Gosh.
Possibly. So, shall I talk about what we first thought it was?
Yes.
Initially, we thought it was due to a change in weather and a change in climate. Mm-hmm. We thought it was due to climate change initially. So, a 1992 paper, which when it was written, if you go back and look at it, it's written with hope that the species still exists.
Oh.
And it's...
So, can I ask, at the time, was it a mystery?
Yeah. Complete mystery. Nobody knew.
That's what's fascinating to me, because I thought you were about to reveal what had happened, but that is what happened for those researchers, right? Like, that's I thought for a second you were, like, leaving a part of the story out, but that, up until then, that was the story, was there were, like, 1,000 and then 10 and then 1 and then 0.
And, like, there's actually a lot of, I'll talk about it, like, the community's response to it in a second. But there are a lot of, like, conflicting ideas about what happened, or there was for a while at least, and a lot of blame being pointed to various people. Again,
this is fascinating.
I'll read some really spicy quotes in a second, because some of them are fab.
This feels like an Agatha Christie situation going on. We're like, who? Was it climate?
And it could definitely be an Agatha Christie, like, title of a book.
Oh, it could. Like,
yes,
yes. Yes.
The Golden Toad. The Mystery of the Golden Toad.
Exactly.
So, answer number one is climate change and a change in the weather. That 1992 paper suggests that the species is simply still burrowing under the ground, waiting for the right rains and the right temperatures to be able to emerge and do breeding. It's a really sad paper to read in retrospect, because it's, like, really, really hopeful and really, really, like, it's fine. We'll find them in, like, 5 years. We're just going through a bit of, like, a time right now. For these toads to be able to breed successfully... Rainfall had to be pretty perfect. Little rain, and these ponds would... See, these ponds dried out, so when the rain came, it would fill them up, just for long enough for the toads to breed, basically. So if there's too little, the ponds aren't full for long enough, so they're not able to breed. If there's too much, the tadpoles get washed away. So they're waiting for these ideal conditions, is essentially what people thought was happening.
Got it.
And then after that point that, you know, maybe those conditions never came and they never continued breeding, basically. At around the time that the species was lost, there was an El Nino Southern Oscillation occurring. Mm. Do either of you two know what that is?
No.
Tom, do you?
I believe it's like a... I don't know how frequently it happens, but it's like a many-year cycle of... like, warmth and humidity that causes, like, hurricanes, I think.
Yeah, so it's a pretty... Some sources say random climactic event, basically. And it's warming and cooling and causes increases and decreases of precipitation. It essentially influences the temperature and precipitation across the globe. Like, it's a really, really influential thing. Again, making the temperatures rise and fall, changing precipitation, all of which is affecting these breeding ponds in Costa Rica, as well as for a lot of other species across the world, from, like, Indonesia all the way across. So it's a really, really big thing. And it's a very good explanation as to what happened to these toads. Acid rain was also another possible culprit. Again, if the acidity in these breeding ponds change, that's it for those tadpoles, they're gone. Nothing was really known for sure, though. There are a lot of papers written at this time sort of speculating as to what's happened. And there was a lot of infighting between conservationists at the time, looking for someone to blame. And a lot of people blamed the team who were working with the toads directly. One person called Harding, I can't find the original paper, I can just find a quote for this in a different paper. But this person named Harding essentially... said that it wasn't this sudden catastrophe and that the team had neglected the toads for years, which obviously is a bold claim to make. They go on to make even bolder claims. They are quoted having said, this is their quote, "I can say with my hand on my heart that I would not have let those golden toad eggs desiccate and die."
Oh, my God.
The man thought...
My God.
He thought that he could single-handedly have saved this species, basically, oh, and had please. That published in 1993.
Well.
Wow.
Well.
Well.
Hand on my heart.
The audacity of it, I swear
the
to God.
The audacity. Where does he get it?
Where did Harding get it? Ah.
I was expecting, like, because, you know, I feel like when it's published, it has to be, like, toned down and in so-and-so speak, but that was savage.
It was savage, really... and the response to that is also pretty spicy.
Let's go! So there was WWF SmackDown!
So... In 1996, Pound and Fogden responded to this, disputed it, said, that's some bullshit, and released this, like, two-page bulletin, basically saying, no, fuck off, no.
Oh, I love it when scientists are, like...
It's so good.
...back and forth printing, like, fuck you, no, fuck yeah. you, the research shit, you killed these frogs, no, you killed them.
It was you, bitch,
What's great... is that, like, instead of, like, firing off a tweet, like, off the dome, you know, they passionately write it, and then they get, like, editors to be like, what do you think? Is that the right word? And then, yes. like, they get yes. people to peer review it and be like, what
like,
do you
this
think?
Was Should published in a journal. Somebody read this and reviewed it.
That is the humor of it, right? It's not even, it's not just a moment. You have to have, it's like weeks or months in the process that you're like, I think this is a good slam down.
This person waited 3 years to respond to that. Oh, my God. Incorrect. Oh. Like, incredible. So if anybody is looking for some 26-year-old drama, I'd really recommend reading their response.
Amazing.
It's called Conservation of a Golden Toad, A Brief History, published by Pound and Fogden in 1996. So that's, if you want to see some scientists in fighting, you want to see what that looks like, it's so worth a read. It's really good.
I just want to say, I questioned how the Golden Toad could become such a saga, but it has become a saga.
Oh, yeah. So, after a few years, hope had essentially been lost, and the Golden Toad was chalked up to being the first species lost due to human-made global warming.
Wow.
Which is a pretty monumental title
really?
To have.
Really? I mean, yeah. I'm guessing that's not how they went, otherwise you wouldn't be talking about this
we
now.
We wouldn't be talking about it.
But do you happen to know what the actual first animal is?
I don't, actually.
I wonder how exponentially that's growing as well. Shall I have a quick Google?
You also gotta wonder how many we just don't know about.
I'm gonna talk about that in a second, yeah, because it is, like, the number of amphibians that we just haven't discovered yet. We are discovering new amphibians, like, every month, basically.
The first mammal to be efficiently driven extinct as a result of human-driven climate change is the Bramble K. Melamie, which is a kind of rodent. It looks like a mouse.
Mm-hmm. R.I.P.
R.I.P. There you go.
So, Golden Toad obviously doesn't have that title anymore. The El Nino event is blamed for it sometimes, but there is another possible cause that was discovered. A pathogen which has impacted so many species that it's thought to be one of the most deadly pathogens in history. This story is not about the Golden Toad. It's actually about the amphibian apocalypse, bitches.
What? What?
That was a real twist and turn there for you folks. So,
have you been reading just like, and then there were none, and like Murder on the Orient Express when you were writing this? This is...
When I was writing this, I was like really worried that this was going to be boring. I'm so glad you both had that response. That's made my day.
Well, yeah, you turned it to the amphibian apocalypse, which is my, again, now, before the Golden Toad is my favorite Indiana Jones story. The amphibian apocalypse is my favorite X-Men arc. This is great. It's not great, I will say.
It's not ideal if
you're
an amphibian.
Doesn't sound like it's going to be great.
Yeah. So I've just given it the title of the most deadly pathogen in history. Do either of you have any clue what it is?
Is it, does it affect humans?
No, it doesn't, which is probably why. And it doesn't impact mammals either, which might be another reason.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, then I probably won't know it.
Out of my jurisdiction. That's there not go. Why. That's why. That's why we got Carolyn on the pod.
Yeah. I'm humans, Carolyn.
I got robots. Yeah. Any computer virus. Yeah. Like Stuxnet. I
Tom,
got
you've
that.
Got robots and slime. Mold.
Exactly. Yeah.
Perfect.
Is it? Can I ask? Is it like fungal, bacterial, or viral?
It's fungal.
Okay, that was gonna
and
be.
And does it control minds?
Can it solve a maze?
Unfortunately, not. Callback.
Callback. Two double callback. Back to back.
There's about to be more callbacks in a second. Don't you worry.
My favorite improv podcast. Let's learn everything.
So since neither of you have heard of the pathogen itself, the fungus that I'm going to talk about, have either of you even heard about amphibian declines in general? Is that something that
Absolutely
you've read about?
Absolutely not.
No. Ella, have
Absolutely
you?
Absolutely not.
No.
I'd be shocked if either of you said yes to either knowing about the pathogen or really knowing about amphibian declines in general. This sort of stuff typically doesn't get
Why
covered
would you, I'm
in
sorry.
The news.
Why would you be shocked?
Yeah, hold on.
As if we
okay.
don't have...
Wow. Huh. Interesting.
We don't have good knowledge of amphibian apocalypses. We are learned people.
Well, it's just that, you know, like, people tend to care more about mammals. It's just, it's a fact. Frogs aren't necessarily the most charismatic animals. Some of them have really gross noses. You know, like, they're just not the cutest animals ever sometimes.
I don't think, we've listened, in a previous episode, we listened to that toad that screams really loudly, and I would say that's the most charming sound I've ever heard.
But also on top of that, so many other groups are going through population declines right now that it's just like another thing on the pile.
Sure.
So that's kind of why I want to talk
that's
about
true,
it today.
That I think every year, a couple of times a year, I'll check what animals have gone extinct this year.
Yeah.
And it's always really long. The list is really long. It's mostly insects, to be fair, but there's a lot of other
also
stuff.
Such like a range of things that are going extinct all the time, and like you maybe will hear about one species in the news and that's it. Everything else just sort of gets
it's hard
lost to... which is why I want to talk about it, just to you know, raise a little bit of awareness for our poor little froggy friends.
Our fallen frog friends, I thought you were gonna say
our fallen frog friends. So the possible pathogen in question, it is a fungus. It's called the chytrid fungus. As is the case with many pathogens, the chytrid fungus has been around for a really long time. It was first discovered in the late 1800s, and most strains are pretty harmless. There are two species of the fungus, though. So there's Batrachia chytrium dendrobatidis, also known as BD, and there's also B. salmon drivorans, also known as B. sal. And these both cause a disease called chytridomycosis, which has caused a decline in a lot of species. So BD itself was discovered in 1993, which is around the time that a lot of people were speculating about the golden toad disappearing and why it might have disappeared. B. sal was discovered in 2013. I'm going to talk a little bit about its mode of function as well, just because it's pretty grisly and it impacts so many different species, so I think it's interesting to talk about.
Yeah.
So its mode of action is kind of nasty. Like a lot of fungal infections, the chytrid fungus affects the amphibian's skin. Can either of you think about why that might be bad for an amphibian?
Isn't that how
they breathe through their skin?
Yeah.
Not only do they respire through their skin, not only do they do their breathing, they do their osmoregulation through their skin, making sure their water levels are balanced, sodium, everything basically happens through their skin.
Wow. Which is why you shouldn't touch frogs.
Which is why you shouldn't touch frogs, yes. So, yeah, basically what happens is the amphibian gets infected, it impacts their skin so much that the amphibian stops being able to respire, osmoregulate, and then gets its sodium levels, which really cause the amphibian to struggle and eventually die. And because the death is relatively slow as well, the fungus has a lot of time to spread around to other amphibians in the area as well. So, which is why that it just passes around in a population so quickly.
Wow.
So in 2007, we thought around 200 species were impacted by the pathogen. Wow. In 2019, we now know that 695 species can be infected. caused declines in 501 species, oh, and at least 90 species have gone completely extinct because of the fungus since the 1980s. This number is also pretty conservative. It's thought that the two strains caused amphibian declines in the 1950s and 60s too.
So it's not just toads and frogs, it's other...
It's salamanders, axolotls, anything like that. Oh, any axolotls. Amphibian is impacted.
Now it's personal.
Oh my god, tiny little smiles.
The fungus now is found in over 60 countries and in every continent. It's not clear where the fungus originated. We don't entirely know. We think it might have originated in possibly Korea, possibly in Africa, but we don't know.
Those are pretty different places.
Those are pretty different places.
So basically, yeah.
Yeah. But what we do know is that once again, it's a human's fault that the fungus spread around so much.
In this case, accidental, I would assume, as in it was picked up and spread through travel.
Could you possibly think of maybe a more specific species that might have helped spread it around? I have mentioned it to both of you before.
Is it a bird?
No, it's amphibian that we've talked about on the podcast.
Is it a pet of some sort?
It can be a pet, but we used it for something else.
Oh, for pregnancy tests?
Yeah.
Oh!
Uh-huh. You might not remember the animal, and that's okay.
Was it not a frog?
Xenopus?
So it was... I think I mentioned the common name for it, which is the African clawed frog.
Yes!
Oh. Yeah!
Xenopus, which means strange foot, and this is the frog that is very commonly used in, and for the same reason that it was used in pregnancy tests, in animal research.
Yeah.
In medical research.
Oh.
There's a big room of them where I do my research. They're just in huge open tanks. And I've accidentally walked into that room a few times and been scared shitless by these huge toads floating around.
They're fab, aren't they?
Oh, so it's research. So what?
Yeah.
So people getting them from the wild for research and breeding them, they spread it, you think, that way?
They think that that's how they spread it around the globe in general.
That's crazy.
The earliest...
Because it's like a standard that it's used in... Wow. Uh-huh. So many things.
The earliest specimen of BD, so that's one of those really nasty funguses, was found in the African clawed frog all the way back in 1938.
Oh, wow.
So it was a specimen from 1938 that they then went and tested again for it, basically.
But I don't understand, like, how did they get out into the wild then?
So what happened is, as the usefulness in science increased, as it was used in pregnancy tests, cancer detection, as a model species in scientific research, all of those things, its global trade of it increased. It got moved around the globe. And because of that, it was found in more labs. And because of that, more frogs escaped.
Oh my god.
Okay.
And because of the nature of an African clawed frog, they are pretty well suited to living pretty much anywhere. There are really invasive species in a lot of different places. And on top of that, BD doesn't kill an African clawed frog.
God damn it, it's an asymptomatic carrier.
Yeah.
No!
We've seen these.
We know all about these. So the African clawed frog basically acted as a reservoir, being carried around from country to country, infecting other species that aren't resistant to the infections. Mm. And obviously it wasn't just the African clawed frog, as things like transporting goods, the pet trade, even possibly like during wars and stuff like that, even as those things increased, different amphibians were being spread around the planet, causing this spread to happen, and nobody even really knew it was happening until it was too late. So that's what we think happened to the golden toad. We think that a specimen got in, something had the infection and just wiped out an entire population of them, basically.
God.
Which is why they weren't seen several years later, which is why like none of them had bred, which is why that 12-year lifespan was cut so short. And that's happening to a lot of other species as well.
Bummer.
Yeah, a little bit of a bummer. I'll try and lighten it up a little bit by talking about what can be done now.
Yay.
Because obviously the golden toad is gone, unfortunately. But a lot of species are still suffering with it.
Yeah, I just want to say real quick that it's like terrifying that it can happen seemingly without a trace, and then leave everyone pointing their fingers at, like, how did this happen?
At each other, blaming each other, saying that, like, yeah, if I was there, I would have saved the eggs and done all of this stuff.
I just want to say, if I was there, I would have saved the eggs.
I would have.
They would not be extinct if I was there.
I think that's the issue with this is, you know, I feel like when you hear about this, you're like, why don't you just not make them, like just save them, right?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it seems like a very, like, tangible thing. It's like, just give them what they need, but...
If I was going extinct, I just wouldn't.
You don't, do you? But, like, I think that's the thing about this species, like, they had everything that they needed. They had the funding, they had the area protected, they had people on the ground, like, making sure that there was enough of the population to sustain itself, and it still collapsed.
Oh,
wow.
And that's really scary.
Wild.
And, like, there were obviously, like, hindsight's a wonderful thing. There were a lot of conversations about, like, if we'd just bred, like, captively bred a small group of them, we could have saved them. And obviously that didn't happen. And that's really easy to say, but it's just like, well, too late now. So, what can be done to help species now? The big one is trying to limit the spread of BD and B-cell, especially for B-cell, since it's not spread around the globe yet. For example, the United States have BD, but they don't have B-cell yet.
Good.
B-cell impacts mostly salamanders, so there have been limitations implemented on salamander importation. Hmm. Around 200 species have been banned from being imported into the States. Hmm. So the people are trying to do stuff. An increase in bioregulation is, like, desperately called for, as well as a reduction in the amphibian trade, which has been called for forever, basically. And since both strains are found in a lot of different pet species as well, obviously if you reduce the pet trade, you're reducing how much the fungus is being spread about. Some frogs are developing the resistance on their own.
Hmm.
60 species previously in decline because of the fungus are now seeming to bounce back.
Wow.
But I am going to sort of leave this small bit on a sort of sad note, because it's not really doing as much as we need it to do. And there's this quote from Lips and Medelson III in the New York Times, and they said, "The invasion continues to haunt field biologists."
Wow.
"We encountered tropical forests practically devoid of amphibians that were once teeming with dozens of species of them."
Wow.
"We watched mass die-offs. We tried to save threatened species by airlifting them out of infected areas, breeding them in captivity, and searching for answers through field and lab research. None of it worked. No cure exists for our populations. Loss of amphibians continued around the globe. We see no significant recovery of populations, and worse, the fungus persists in the environment, preventing the reintroduction of captive animals." Like, that's how bad this situation has gotten, basically.
Apocalypse is not an exaggeration.
No, like, it is legitimately that bad. So essentially what that article was asking for was more bioregulation, strict regulations on the pet trade, and for the governments to do more. All super helpful suggestions, but with the state of the world right now, it doesn't seem like any of that's going to happen anytime soon. Plus, once again, it doesn't do much for the golden toad because it's gone. It's never coming back. Or is it? Ooh!
What?
What?
What? Another twist?
What?
This episode has been pretty heavy, and I don't want to take away from what I've just said because it is really, really serious. So I just wanted to end this on a little bit more of a lighthearted note.
What?
There are people out there who legitimately think that the golden toad is still out there somewhere. And we might want to laugh at those people and think that they're really, really silly, since the golden toad hasn't been sighted in 33 years now. But I don't think it's totally a crazy idea. I'd actually like to talk about a different toad species called Holdridge's toad. It's another toad species, endemic to the same cloud forest in Costa Rica. This toad was last observed in 1986, so that's 3 years prior to the last golden toad sighting. This toad was declared extinct in 2008, again after years and years of extensive searches for the toad. It was considered extinct when, as defined by the IUCN, there was no reasonable doubt that the last specimen had died. Like, this thing was gone. There was no hope for it. again, the chytrid fungus was blamed for it. BD was blamed. And especially given how close the species was to where the golden toad lived, they thought that was a pretty reasonable explanation to give. Basically, these two species, possibly how the chytrid fungus got into the golden toad population in the first place. They were so closely linked together that it made sense that was how this toad was lost. It was then found again in the same year that it was declared extinct.
Yay!
Wow! They're like, hey, excuse me, wait a second.
So the same year that it was declared extinct, juveniles were also found, suggesting that recent breeding had occurred. The photos taken were not of good quality, so these sightings could not be confirmed until 2010. But in 2010, the species was moved from extinct to critically endangered, which I believe is where the species remains now. So that species somehow survived after 25 years of literally zero sightings in an area where the chytrid fungus was prevalent, literally just down the road from where the golden toads were existing.
So they probably developed some kind of resistance to it.
Some kind of resistance to it, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So, is it possible that the golden toad simply hasn't been observed and is out there somewhere? People like Trevor Ritland believe so. This man has gone out to the Cloud Forest, he's spoken to a lot of the locals there, and he claims that one particular story is really, really interesting to him. This story was told by a well-known farmer turned conservationist in Monteverde, and it is this story about how this man had found a hidden pool a few years after the last sighting of the golden toad, full of males, females, and juvenile golden toads.
Huh?
I hope that's true.
It'd be wonderful, wouldn't it? But you can read that, and when I first read this article, I was like, come on, really? Like,
I know a guy who knows a guy who...
And then I read the end of the article, and I would like to just read the quote that is at the end of this as well. This is specifically regarding the conservation efforts in the area following the toad's declared extinction. The local people, the biologists, the farmers, the old Quakers who travelled to those green hills long ago, have prepared a place for it to come back. Some are motivated by the hope that it's still out there. Others are driven by the certainty of its extinction, committed to stopping the same fate from befalling other local residents. The quetzals, the glass frogs, the endemic orchids that lay hidden like immortal pearls, but all of them are working together to preserve a place for it in memory or in hope of its return.
Yay.
And I just think that's really lovely.
Wow.
What a message of hope at the end of it. And if that's the reason why people are conserving the area in the hope that the toad will return, who am I to argue with them, really?
Mm.
Wow.
In the face of the literal amphibian apocalypse, people have so much hope, and hope that other species won't suffer potentially the same fate. And I just think that if people care a little bit about the golden toad, maybe a little bit about the chytrid fungus and the effect that it's having, and maybe get other people to care about it, then things can be done to preserve these 7,000 species of amphibians that have been discovered so far. 70% of amphibians are in decline at the moment. 30% of that is possibly due to the chytrid fungus.
Jeez.
And whilst it's too late for the golden toad, it's not necessarily too late for all of them as well. So there you go. That's the story of the golden toad.
That was a great story. That was a very harrowing narrative you took us through. All the twists and turns.
Of international intrigue.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so ready for this question, Tom.
I'm so excited.
Oh, I'm glad. So, today's question is, how many human objects are on the moon? And so, you two guess a number, and then I'll say the real number, and then we'll hop onto the miscellaneous topic.
Woo! Perfect!
Amazing, perfect. Okay.
Quickest question ever.
517.
I might go a bit higher than that. Do I go higher or do I go lower?
Whoever gets it wins the golf cart that... Tom has.
What?
It's the Price is Right.
Yeah. So, I'm gonna say 1,012.
Wow.
Now, what are y'all's reasonings for these numbers? I'm very curious.
Okay, here's my reasoning. There have been a limited number of human trips to the moon. since the first in 1969. And they've all been in the USA, as far as I'm aware. I don't think Russia has ever been.
Correct.
And there hasn't been one for since
1972.
And there was like 6 to 8, I would guess.
So we're gonna break down these numbers actually, because I think they're gonna help y'all estimate. But you're actually pretty spot on with these estimates, Alice.
Oh yeah, I wanna say, like, I don't think there are many things that we've left after missions. I think there's so much debris that we've put into space already that some of it must eventually fall onto the moon, right?
I think we have left because loads of stuff, because to get back with the fuel and the weight and stuff, they have to leave like all of their feces. I know that they leave that behind at the very least, and they probably leave some trash, I imagine. I imagine there's a lot of trash on the moon.
Oh, why are humans like this?
I know.
You can't take us anywhere.
I'm just really fascinated that y'all have these numbers ready, locked and loaded.
Do we count individual pieces of human poop as one thing or as like 20?
I think they vacuum pack it or something like that. Okay. Maybe it's like per vacuum pack of poo.
All right. So let's get down to this. And I think something that might help us get a little closer is breaking down how many times we've actually been to the moon. So,
right.
And also, I just want to say, before we get into the numbers, having done research where I've had to scour papers trying to figure out like how many bones a giraffe has, it's so nice to research something that is so amazingly well documented. Like,
of course,
with any attempt to quantize animals, there's always like an Arctic sloth that's gonna pop up and it's gonna completely ruin the data set, where it's like, oh, dude, don't forget about this. I'm just so glad. because like, it's hard to inconspicuously do a moon mission, you know? So we have the data pretty down pat. There aren't many like sneaky...
There's never been a secret mission to the moon.
Exactly.
Unless it was by...
an Arctic sloth. So having all this data means that we get to do some fun data breakdown. So let's break it down. Woo! So according to NASA, there have been 111 lunar missions spanning from 1958 to 2020, across all countries, not just the U.S.
More than I thought there were.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But that's not landing on the moon.
Exactly.
Orbiting.
We're going to break it down. So of those 111, only 58 were marked as fully successful.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, there are some like partial failures. There are some like orbiters that, you know, fly loose, but they collect some data. There are some that are total failures, but... Mm-hmm. In descending order of frequency, these missions are, you have lunar orbiters, so that orbit around the moon, you have unmanned landers, like, you know, robots and rovers, you have flybys, and you have impactors, where you just, like, chuck something into the moon. So those are obviously still there. And then, perhaps the most difficult are missions categorized as sample returns, where... as you'd expect, you collect a sample from the moon and return it. I found this extremely funny. On NASA's list of lunar missions, the Apollo 11 mission, which was the one where humans first landed on the moon, is labeled as a sample return mission.
Okay.
Which is technically true.
You're not wrong, I guess.
But I do find that hilarious, as if like the three astronauts were like, hey, we heard you're doing like a sample return mission, can we just like hop on and help, like, since you're gonna get samples anyway, please, like, we'll pay for gas. If not, can you just grab some chicken nuggets for us? Anyway, space chicken nuggets. Anyway, so of these,
that I would like a sound bite of Tom saying space chicken nuggets.
Space chicken nuggets. So of these 58 successful missions, there were 3 crewed orbits or flybys that had humans, and there were 6 crewed landings, which is, Ella had almost exactly on the number, I think.
Yeah, 6 to 8, I thought there were, so yeah. Nice.
And with 12 astronauts ever being on the moon. So
that's it.
Knowing these, yeah.
Wow.
Does it count if they stayed in the...
Yes, it does. They don't have to step foot on the moon. They have to be on the moon.
Because there was that, the third guy, who I don't know the name of, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and the third guy.
The other one.
Yeah.
You have to stay in the...
the lander, yeah.
I'd be so pissed if I was that person.
I know,
just putting that out
there.
Yeah. Can we swap over for a bit, folks? Buzz, can you let me out there for like 2 minutes?
Can we put his name out there just so people know?
Oh, yeah.
Right, and obviously I...
You totally had it prepped, right?
Yep, uh-huh. Because we all know that on this podcast, we stan Michael Collins.
Michael Collins!
Michael Collins!
Well done, Michael Collins.
You were on the moon, my
You
dude.
Were on the moon.
You yeah. were on the moon!
Uh-huh. As if a fucking astronaut needs validating by us.
Good point.
You might answer this question in a second. Do things collide with the moon, like our satellites and stuff, or is that like less of a thing that happens?
I don't think our satellites are colliding with the moon. So Elon Musk would have something to say about that.
We refer to everything as a satellite.
I thought you meant like actual satellites.
But like space debris. Do we know if any of that ends up on the moon?
Space trash on the moon.
So I don't believe so because the distance from the moon is deceptively large. Yeah. Like low Earth orbit is on the scale of like 1,000 miles
mm-hmm.
and the distance to the moon is on the scale of like 200,000 miles.
Okay.
Shit.
That is on the moon that is human made has been deliberately left there, basically.
I believe so, yes. So that far. We've kept track of. Again, like I said at the beginning, I believe it's relatively hard to get stuff on the moon.
Yeah.
Challenge accepted, Tom.
Get this podcast on the moon.
I might bring my guess down a little bit to like 864. There we go.
864. All right.
I hope I'm getting closer.
I'm staying where I am for now.
Staying firm.
And I just got that buff because I'm going to say the number. So I'm just curious, what are these objects that you think besides the waves?
All I can say is poo.
All you can say is it's, according to Ella, it's 517 discrete units of poop.
You must, like, how long does the trip take over from from Earth to the Moon? How long did the first one
I wouldn't
take?
Know.
I think it was like, was it like 3 days or something?
Let me see. About 3 days, yeah.
Oh, okay.
You're on the money.
Oh, I must have retained a lot more information from these documentaries than I thought. Okay, so actually, you probably wouldn't poo that much.
Bits of spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it have to like leave its little legs behind?
It has to leave its little thing behind, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
Yeah. So bits of spaceship. Did they need the spaceship to be light upon its return?
I thought that's the thing, right? Like, it's a fuel thing. This is like normal for any space travel.
Yeah. So minimizing.
Possibly like any waste at all that they had within the spaceship that they could leave behind, they did, basically.
Like the packets, food packets.
The
and
food
stuff.
Packets, mm-hmm. yeah.
And I know, look, they played some golf, so.
Okay, so the Wall Street Journal splits them into four categories. That get progressively fewer. So the biggest category is scientific tools.
Scalpels and shovels.
And also like active recording devices that some are still relevant.
That makes sense. Why do I think scalpels? What are they cutting out of the moon?
How many surgeries are they performing on the moon, Ella?
So many.
That's in 6 weeks. That's my question. So, hey, don't you dare. The second biggest category are personal objects, which includes trash.
Okay.
The category after that are spacecraft from previous missions.
Okay.
And then the last category that Ella kind of mentioned with the golf balls, but are symbolic objects that are left on the moon, that are purposefully left on the moon.
So, like, the flag.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay,
I'm staying where I am.
Maybe I want to go up again. You know what? No, I'm going to stick with my number. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you did, Carolyn, because according to the Wall Street Journal, as of 2019, there are 809 human objects on the moon.
Amazing!
Ooh.
I'm really blown away. I'm really kind of... both of your numbers were really close. I would have guessed like 100, maybe.
No, yeah, you got
was it. My first guess.
So much poo.
We just leave so much shit everywhere that of course we'd leave a lot of it on the moon.
So that source comes from this great PDF from NASA titled Catalog of Man-Made Material on the Moon. We'll definitely throw it in the show notes because it goes on and on and on. But again, the Wall Street Journal splits them into four categories that get progressively fewer. So there are, this would blew me away, there are 622 scientific tools on the moon.
That's crazy.
I would never have guessed that.
Yeah. Which, you know, makes sense. I mean, that's great. That's cool.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's actually a good thing that is there.
I'm glad that it's that proportion of stuff.
Yeah,
but I guess
me
in my
too.
Head, because it was so few actual fully successful missions, in
yeah,
my head it would be
yeah.
like maybe one or two things left behind each time, not such a high number.
They get broken down into like component pieces.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that makes sense.
Like a camera can include like the body of the camera and also lenses, filters, cables, you know, the remote control for the camera. Again, if anyone wants to dig into this, I highly recommend. It's really, I only got to pick out a few to highlight because there's so many, but it's really, I kept finding up until the yesterday, finding wild stuff. So
wow.
622 scientific tools, 97 personal objects, which includes the trash and the food bags.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to Ella's point, a lot of them are condensed into bags. You know, they weren't throwing them onto the moon. So that reduces the number a bit. 71 spacecraft from previous missions. And the reason there are so many is some failed ones just kind of
landed there.
Sometimes
eventually.
A failed one can land in there. And then there are 19 symbolic objects.
Ooh, what are the symbolic objects then?
We will get into those. We're going to save the best for last because those are kind of fun. But yeah, there's enough to make a whole We Didn't Start the Fire end of the world song listing those all out.
You should record that.
Oh
no.
My god, yes. But I just, like...
Nope, I was going to try.
Yeah. Golf balls and flags and... That's it. And bags of poop.
And poop. And there's more poop. More some trash. There's some poop.
Science objects poop. And
If there's somebody who's going to see the moon, and there's just all of this crap there, how disappointing
Genuine,
must that end up
the
being?
Reason I knew there was so much shit up there is because of the amount of tweets I've seen. Being like, why do humans leave so much trash on the moon?
Of course, like you said, though, we do know some of the reasons is because that's the only way to get back, right?
It's the only way to get back, yeah.
So, we're going to break these down category by category. We're going to start with the scientific tools. So, there's obviously a bunch. It's the biggest category. We can't list them all. Can you think of some tools that you would want to put on the moon?
Scalpels. All of the surgeries, all of the moon surgeries.
I would guess anything to record things like temperature.
Oh yeah, like, which is a good idea.
Light levels.
Rock acidity.
I don't know. Maybe like.
What'd you say, Ella?
Rock acidity.
Ooh.
Well, yeah, stuff to like atmospheric stuff.
All I can think of is the Mars rover. You know, the Mars rover like, pat the ground really hard.
Oh.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it.
Because I don't know why I'm gendering the Mars rover, but it sings, it sings happy birthday to itself, right? When it's, by, like, beating it out on the ground in Mars, so.
We gotta talk about the rovers one day. So, obviously, there's a lot of different tools. You know, you have magnetometers are one, obviously some cameras, you have four undetonated grenades, you have antennae.
Wait, what?
You have, huh?
Wait, what?
What? Antennae, cameras?
No.
The magnetometers measure magnetic waves and fields.
I was going to ask, and then...
Four undetonated grenades?
You mentioned
so
the grenades.
We'll get into that. So
wait,
anyway,
The grenades count as scientific equipment and not under, like, the dodgy miscellaneous category at the end?
Yes, and we'll get into it. But first, there's a great TikTok by Astro Alexandra about the retro reflectors on the moon. Which are a really, basically what they are is they're an array of small, specially designed mirrors that can reflect light back to their source. Like, that's what a retroreflector does.
I hate that I'm about to utter this sentence. But is that the thing out of that one episode of The Big Bang Theory where they try to shoot lasers at the moon?
I think I know what you're talking about. They're shooting a laser at one of these reflectors. And
really?
They get sent back to them. It's actually probably one of the nicer bits of The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, that sounds on the money. it's like an array of mirrors. By firing a laser at these retroreflectors and then measuring the response you get back, this allows you to measure the distance from the Earth to the moon to literally millimeter accuracy, which is nuts.
That's so cool.
Which is especially nuts because, again, the moon is deceptively far away. It is 384,400 kilometers away.
Wow.
You can fit 30 Earths between the Earth and the moon.
Wow.
It's mad.
And a paper on these retroreflectors goes, such high-precision measurements have manifold applications, such as tests on gravitational physics, Lorentz invariance, and studies of geophysics and selenophysics. So it's fascinating to have this measurement. But obviously, there is another tool that I mentioned that I think was the coolest, or maybe I didn't mention it. I don't remember. But for me, one of the most particular interesting tools on the moon were geophones and seismometers. And do you know what those measure?
Say them again.
Geophones and seismometers. I didn't even realize they were two different things.
Rock.
But they are. Slightly different.
Geophones and...
Rock. Something to do with rocks. Geo.
It must
be. No, location. Something to do with location. No, I don't know.
So, they measure moonquakes.
Oh!
Which is my favorite word to come out of this research. We really need to, like, keep a list of all the great science words we've accrued because some of them are so delightful. But moonquakes sound like a Ben and Jerry's flavor for some reason. It sounds very dessert-like.
Sounds like it should be a cereal.
Yeah, moonquakes.
Moonquakes.
Part of a daily dose of breakfast. I don't know how to say anything.
A daily dose of breakfast.
A daily
diet.
Dose. So at first, seismometers for me were like an afterthought on the list, right? Like cameras, rovers, they all feel very intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
But then I came across this quote from a press release from NASA that came out in 2019. And it goes, the moon is shrinking as its interior cools, getting more than 150 feet or 50 meters skinnier over the last several hundred million years. Just as a grape...
Okay, that's all right. I thought you were about to say, like, several years. I know. And I was like, Jesus Christ.
That was a real bait and switch there. The quote continues, just as a grape wrinkles as it shrinks down to a raisin, the moon gets wrinkles as it shrinks.
Aww.
Unlike the flexible skin of a grape, the moon's surface crust is brittle, so it breaks as the moon shrinks, forming thrust faults, where one section of crust is pushed up over a neighboring part. And there are moonquakes that have reached a 5 on the Richter scale, which, according to a table I found, a 5 on the Richter scale means felt by everyone difficult to stand. So,
wow.
Oh my God.
No joke. And part of that research from 2019 was helped by, quote, data from 4 seismometers placed on the moon by the Apollo astronauts, which happened 50 years ago.
Oh.
So that's pretty wild. But the geophones and seismometers get even stranger because... Do you want to know what you do when you don't want to wait around for a moonquake?
You cause one. You cause one with a grenade.
There it is.
No. Why are we setting off grenades? What's the point?
Why are humans like this?
There are points to this, but this is a quote from a paper by Kovich, Watkins, and Landers, and it goes... The mortar package is positioned to fire the 4 grenades in a northerly direction in alignment with the geophone line. So I'm not sensationalizing it by calling them grenades. They are. I'm sure they don't look like typical grenades, but that's how they're referred to. And so they would set them up and then wait until the astronauts returned home to remotely fire them. Smart.
Yeah.
And this is something that NASA did twice on both of the Apollo 14 and 16 missions. And this is a quote from the paper by Kovic and team. It goes, the purpose of the active seismic experiment is to generate and monitor seismic waves in the lunar near surface and to use these data to study the internal structure of the moon to a depth of approximately 460 meters.
Yeah.
So I think it's very easy for us to forget that, like, the moon is the closest stellar body to us, right? For the longest time with these experiments, we've had a sample size of 1, which is the Earth, right? Which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have the ability to increase the sample size for our geological studies to 2. However, from those experiments, a total of 4 grenades remained unfired. And to this day, are still on the moon. So
Fire the grenades! Fire the grenades!
Are there any plans to fire the grenades?
I don't believe so.
Oh, they're just there. Oh, that's nice.
I feel like that seems unsafe. They should probably do it before anyone else goes back.
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
But again, you know, don't know when that's going to happen necessarily. So.
Isn't it crazy that from the 60s, all of our moon missions happened, and then nothing has happened since? I find that bonkers.
Yeah.
It's arguably efficient, you could say, you know, in terms of...
Yeah, I guess there's no reason to send people back, right?
Yeah. I feel like folks have this pull that's like simultaneously, don't spend money on space, and also, why haven't we been on the moon? And I feel like there's a reason for both of those answers.
I see tweets quite often about we should stop spending money on like space research until we solve all of the problems on Earth. And I don't think those people understand, first of all, how research funding
right,
works.
How you solve those problems. Yeah, literally. And also research funding. Yeah,
and also
the process.
Like the fact that, your first solution should not be to stop research funding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there are other things. Anyway.
I have you might not know the answer to this question. How long can space grenades be viable for? Could the space grenades be set off now? Or is it too far, too late? I want to know these answers. I might have to Google them myself in a minute.
I don't know if there will be a Yahoo's Answers for how long do space grenades last, but all power to you. Good luck.
I'll let you know what I find.
Anyway, explosives aren't the only trash we've left on the moon. And Ella has been very excited to mention this. And I'm very proud to announce that there is indeed poop on the moon.
Woo!
So I told my friend this, and they said, who's poop? Which I love. Like I know, right, they're all from missions with humans on the moon, but I do like to imagine that, like, before we landed on the moon, that, like, we sent, like, the president's poop to the moon or something like that.
That sounds like something Americans might do.
Oh my god, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. According to The Atlantic and the BBC, there are, quote, 96 bags of urine, feces, and vomit.
Oh, I didn't think about urine.
Vomit?
Except, and I found this a really interesting detail, there was actually a correction issued by Elizabeth Succo that said, quote, while astronauts have vomited in space, none have done so on a lunar landing mission. Which obviously means we need to go back.
I would like to put my name forward for the first person's vomit to be on the moon.
Elizabeth then goes on to, in her correction, name all the astronauts that have narfed in space. And goes, quote, you can find more detail on these incidents and other Apollo in-flight medical issues in Biomedical Results, Section 2, Chapter 1. So, obviously going to link that in the show notes.
Yeah.
That's amazing. This woman was just like, nah, fuck this. I'm going to list all of them.
I just love that because, once again, it really shows how well documented everything is.
Oh,
it's
God,
like, actually, they didn't narf, because if they had, we would have known. Check out Section 2, Chapter 1, sweetie.
Wow.
So, the one thing that is interesting is that the waste left by the Apollo astronauts isn't just silly. It turns out it may be scientifically interesting. I found this Vox headline, and it's so great, I just have to read it. It's from Brian Resnick, and it goes, Apollo astronauts left their poop on the moon. We gotta go back for that shit.
Hey.
What 50-year-old dirty diapers can teach us about the potential origins of life on Earth.
Oh, so, bacteria. What bacteria is, like, surviving
exactly.
in that atmosphere, lack of
exactly.
atmosphere.
Exactly. Because if you think about it, the bacteria in human waste is biological life that is on the moon today. It might be dead, but it's organic material that is on the moon. So the article mentions this paper by Schuerger et al. From 2019 titled A Lunar Microbial Survival Model for Predicting the Forward Contamination of the Moon. And this is a quote. The surface conditions on the moon are extremely harsh, with high doses of ultraviolet irradiation, wide temperature extremes, low pressure, and high levels of ionizing radiation. And the temperature can range from negative 170 degrees Celsius at night to 140 degrees Celsius at noon.
The moon is so fucking hot. I saw a TikTok about this that was like, the moon be warm.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh my god. And I'm like, this is something that never like went through my brain until I watched that. I was like, the moon's hot.
Of course it is, though.
Like duh,
it's like, it's just like, it's basically just like an extreme desert, right? We know that the desert gets super cold at night and super hot in the day because there's nothing, there's no protection, there's nothing, there's beaming sun radiation or
although,
not.
You know, I think to Carolyn's point, like, I've never seen a photograph of a human in a more extreme environment. And so it's hard to realize, you know what I mean? Like,
that's an interesting thing. I'd like to know what their suits are made of to protect them from the specific heat and or cold.
So maybe that's a question for another time.
If anyone knows, pop it in the Discord.
Whoop whoop.
So the paper continues, and so these trash bags were called jet bags, as in they were jettisoned out. And so the paper goes, if the jet bags with human waste and sleep restraints were placed under the lunar module descent stages, they would have the richest microbial bioburdens and species diversity of the accessible materials on the moon. And I love that word also, bioburdens.
Wow, yeah.
The idea is basically just that, how does microbial life handle these circumstances? Mm-hmm. It's unlikely they're alive, but, you know, gleaning how they died is also interesting. How long did they survive? Were they able to lie dormant? That's one theory they have. And, like, what dangerous aspect killed them first? So there may be some scientific value to cleaning up after ourselves. But somewhere in the scale between science and garbage, we have perhaps the category that is most interesting, because it's interesting both scientifically and artistically, and those are symbolic objects left on the moon.
Yeah.
And because they're symbolic, what I'd love for y'all to do, if you wouldn't mind, is as we go through them, rate them on a scale, on a 5-star scale.
Yes.
Would y'all be willing to do that?
Yeah, let's do it.
Judges, how will you be grading these objects? What's important to you?
Meaningfulness to the planet.
Yep. You're not gonna like this first one, Ella.
I know. I'm guessing it's the American flag, which is immediately a 1-star. Why? It drives me insane that flag is up there.
Yeah.
Ella, I'm gonna hate to burst your bubble, but we'll get to that in a second. But Carolyn,
if I think it's dumb, it gets 1-star, and that's like literally all I can give you. We'll see.
Humor. More stars for humor.
I agree with that personally. So, as a baseline, what do you guys give poop?
5. Hilarious.
Yeah, 5. Carolyn?
I it loses a point because I hate that we left it up there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it regains half a point because of scientific interest. I give it a 4.5.
Wow, yeah. Okay. All right, let's dig through this.
Quite a high bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, truly.
The bar is human poop.
I really thought y'all were going to give that a 1. Okay, amazing. So, oh boy, Ella, it breaks my heart to tell you this. What would you guys rate the 5 American flags that are on the moon?
5? Are you having a 0, fucking
minus 10? Minus 20. That's awful.
I will give
What's
you one. I will give you
people.
I would have given 1-star for the first one that the first trip put up there, but that's 5 is unreal and unnecessary.
5 is ridiculous.
Could they not put like a world flag up or something? Like,
can they not can they just fucking not?
We're so mad. I just want to say, if it was the Union Jack, the British flag, I would also be unhappy.
Oh no,
this isn't about.
I'd possibly be more unhappy if it was.
I would also be more unhappy with being the British flag.
I'd
imagine
hate
colonization.
Also,
we've colonized the moon.
That's the thing. We totally would. If we were the ones going up there, we would have left more flags up there because we suck. So this isn't like an anti-American thing.
Yeah, no,
we just
really
hate that. Yeah. Wow.
Wow. Oh boy, howdy. Again and again, I'm a hard agree.
Wait, so out of the 19 items that are up there, over a quarter of them.
Wow, I hadn't considered that.
Over a quarter of them are American flags.
That's
what
a joke.
What the fuck?
Okay, go
anyway,
on.
Anyway, let's
on.
Continue on. There is a small gold olive branch that they left on the moon.
Nice. It's for future aliens, right?
Yeah.
I assume.
Why did they pick that?
It's a piece, it's a sign of peace, right?
Yeah.
Is it a
symbol
of
peace?
Okay, yeah. I give that maybe a 4. Yeah.
Cool. One astronaut dropped just a silver pin. I couldn't find any more details on the significance, but kind of mysterious.
I'm guessing that has probably had some personal significance. Like, if I was to go to the moon, I'd probably drop something for, like, a family. Like, imagine you putting something that belonged to you on the moon. Like, that's pretty... I would give that a 3 just for
Yeah, 2.5.
I mean, bad for littering, but nice for them.
I get it.
We have a disc containing microscopically etched messages from the leaders of 73 countries.
Love. Really good. Still five American flags.
How big is this disc?
That is the thing. It's like, I guess it would be about the size of, you know, like twice the size of your average coin kind of a thing. And they are microscopically etched.
It
so
loses
it's not...
points purely because the American flag also exists there. If the American flag
weren't
there,
it would
get
something
five.
The size of a flag with messages on, but a disc.
Yeah.
So I guess at four.
The human poop is bigger than the disc.
Oh, definitely. Like, most definitely. We have... I love this one. Sorry, not to bias y'all. We have a falcon's feather that was used to do an experiment where they dropped a feather and a hammer at the same time on the moon.
Oh, that's nice. Aww. Yeah, science. I'm going to give that
five.
I'll
give that a five, yeah.
I also like that because it's like a... something besides a human is also interesting.
I was wondering if there was any animal stuff, so that's... I like that, yeah.
Yeah.
There's so many frogs. The rest are all frogs.
If one that's the golden answer, toad. They all get five.
Like Ella mentioned, there are two golf balls and an improvised javelin for what one astronaut called, quote, the first Lunar Olympics.
Five.
Cute.
Five. That gets
five.
Really funny.
That's funny, and I don't mind that they played golf up there. It seems like a good pastime.
If they called it the first Lunar Olympics, I love it. That's hilarious.
Apparently, they were extremely rushed for this. Like, they had very little time. So they were like, we gotta do it. It wasn't like a leisurely thing.
And they like made a javelin.
It was like from like a broken pole or something like that. It was improvised.
I love that for them.
I'm glad y'all love that one.
Yeah, that's fun.
And then the last one I'm going to mention, I'm going to send a picture of it to y'all because I think it is beautiful. It is a photograph of an astronaut's family.
Oh, that's a five.
Yeah. You got five. That's very sweet.
And it's got his kids in the picture. Oh my God.
That's pretty nuts. There's a few I'm not going to ask y'all to rate. There are a handful of memorials to fallen astronauts, including a small metal figure of an astronaut next to a plaque containing the names of astronauts that have died.
I like that you're being respectful. And what if I was just like, one?
One!
I have, in my head, rated that as a five, so...
And there are also the ashes of Eugene Schumacher, who, according to NASA, it's a polycarbonate capsule, 1 3/4 inches long and 7/10 inches in diameter, is carried in a vacuum-sealed, flight-tested sleeve mounted deep inside the spacecraft. So it's not like they spread the ashes around, but it is on the moon.
Oh, you know what? Put my ashes on the moon.
That'd be so cool.
That's sick.
Mm-hmm.
And there we go. That's the items on the moon. We couldn't go through all 809 of them, but in the show notes, we'll link the list of everything on the moon.
And on the Patreon, we will put us just listing every single item. One.
Well, actually, sorry, I should clarify that. That's that list that we're going to post is everything officially reported on the moon. Because as much as I joked about how could you possibly sneak on the moon, what you could do is sneak some thing on the moon.
Who snuck something on the moon? What?
So, the MoMA lists on their website something called the Moon Museum. It's a silicon tile that's not even 2 centimeters long, so smaller than a coin, that has 6 drawings from 6 artists, including Andy Warhol, Klaus Oldenburg, David Neurose, Robert Rauschberg, Forrest Myers, and John Chamberlain. And this is the tile, I'm going to send y'all a picture, that is allegedly on the moon. So here it is.
One of the pictures for listeners at home is just a penis. And I want to say, I'm going to say this immediately, I'm unhappy with this. Because if they're going to sneak something from artists on the moon, let's get a representative group of artists and not 6 white men.
I 100% agree. Yeah, literally. 100% agree with that. But yes, there is, of one of those 6 drawings, there is, well, here's how the MoMA describes it. Quote, Andy Warhol drew his initials, which also read as a penis or a space rocket.
It's a dick and balls.
Warhol, why?
It 100% is.
What a knob.
But yeah, how would y'all get this on the moon?
I would pay off an astronaut, or like not bribe, but just ask an astronaut to do it, because I assume they get weighed, like Formula One race car drivers who have to get weighed before and after the race to make sure that they're not putting too much or too little fuel in or whatever. I imagine they weigh the astronauts, so it's very small.
Yeah, it's either that or they paid one of the engineers to put it in with like one of the things that was being sent up there. And because it's so small, just sort of like hid it in the thing. Yeah.
There's a great investigation into this that PBS did, where they talked to the artist, they talked to an astronaut on that mission it was sent on, and an engineer who worked on the lunar lander. So the man that on the inside they had remained completely anonymous to this day. And the person who was the connection between the artist and the inside man passed away. But we do have extremely strong evidence in spite of that, because PBS interviewed Richard Kupchak, who worked on the team building the lunar landers and oversaw the launch. And in the interview, he takes the reporter, brings her to a replica of the lander, and shows her that sort of like gold foil skirt of the lander that you can maybe visualize, that like gold bottom portion. And he goes, quote, "It's been 40 years since we've even talked about this, and I feel comfortable talking to you about it now." He then peels back the first layer of the gold foil and then says, "This is a blanket, and there are about 16 layers of this. There are small personal items that the fellas put in between the blankets of the spacecraft," which would include photographs of family, and Richard believes it's very likely that that's how the Moon Museum got on the moon.
That makes sense.
He goes on to say, "Never ever was there anything that was done to the spacecraft that would be a safety issue." And he goes, "Was it wrong? Yes. But we were caught up into this thing, and we were good, and we knew it, and we left our mark."
Was it wrong? Like, was it wrong? Like, I mean, as maybe... long as they were aware of any, like, weight and size changes they made to the craft, then I don't see the issue.
Maybe somebody should have said no to the penis part, but you know, like...
I'm pretty annoyed that there's Andy Warhol's penis on the moon, like, that's pretty shit.
Yeah.
And now that we're coming to a close, I want to ask, which was your favorite? And also, more importantly, what would y'all leave on the moon, if you could?
Ooh.
I would leave a USB or something like that with a copy of this podcast.
Oh my god.
A Rosetta Stone kind of thing, probably.
Ooh, yeah. I love that.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes sense in terms of, you know,
that's really cool
stuff.
My favorite was the family photo.
Yeah.
I don't know why. That just like struck a really lovely chord. I was like, that's nice.
It's really
I
powerful.
Like that. Yeah. What did I put on the moon? Can I be really obnoxious and say one of my own paintings?
Yeah, well, of course, this isn't legally binding, Carolyn.
I would legally put,
although this, although actually, I would be careful what you say because this recording is being sent on the moon, so yeah. I would be careful in that sense.
I would put a really gay little frog painting on the moon.
I would put my name. I would put my name on something on the moon because that's
I'd graffiti a stone for sure. Yeah. No questions asked, would graffiti a stone, yeah.
I thought just like a puzzle of some kind would be interesting. I feel like that transcends language as a thing. I also thought it would be great. I mean, first of all, I agree with y'all that I think it's important to represent more than white men. But I thought it'd be really cute to have something that a kid made. I don't know why. I think that spirit would be interesting.
A child's drawing of the moon.
Oh, I do love that.
Or a child's drawing of the earth would be cute as well.
I love that. We can debate forever what would have been better to put on the moon. But the one thing I think could not have been done better is something I've said at the beginning and have said throughout. And that's that this whole process was documented so extensively, from the experiments to the mistakes to the poop. you know, I think we can judge the scientific and artistic decisions like the grenades, but the reason we can judge them at all is because it's all been recorded and documented and shared with everyone, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And it was documented so well to the point where we have a final little audio recording I wanted to play. This is the last thing that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin did before getting back into their craft. They're literally on the ladder on the way up, and it's Neil reminding Buzz to drop off these symbolic objects that brought because he had forgotten. So I'll play it real quick.
How about that baggage out of your sleeve? Get that? No. Okay, I'll get it. I get up there. Let it now? That's all. Okay? Okay.
So it's a little hard to hear, but we have a transcript. So if y'all could read it out, would one of you like to be Neil, one of you like to be Buzz?
I'll be Neil.
I'll be Buzz.
Okay. How about that package out of your sleeve? Get that?
No.
Okay, I'll get it when I get up there.
Want it now?
Guess so.
From Neil's actions in the TV record, it appears that Buzz has tossed the package down to the surface. It falls to Neil's right. He turns and apparently moves it slightly with his foot.
Okay.
Okay.
I love, that was what made me chuckle so much in the recording, is you can clearly hear him asking, like, did you do the thing? And he just goes, no.
this is a quote from Aldrin later on. He said, we had forgotten about this up to this point, and I don't think we really wanted to totally openly talk about what it was, so it was sort of guarded, and I knew what he was talking about. And I just find that delightful. You know, aww. I think the golden olive branch is maybe too perfect and pristine to be like an honest representation of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
But when you combine it with the family photograph and like the rogue art and the scientific tools strewn about and the poop and the fact that we almost forgot to drop the actually important ones, I think we did an okay job of showing what humanity is like.
Yeah.
I think, ironically, if I could leave something on the moon, it would be the story of getting there, right? Like the poop and the forgetfulness and all. So that's it.
Okay. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, fancy seeing you here.
That was nice. This week's miscellaneous topic, as you guys seem to be familiar with, is a 4,000-year-old Mesopotamian bar joke.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this specific joke makes its rounds on the internet every now and then.
Mm.
But in particular, it has been making its rounds last week.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this tweet from someone called at Babadook Spinoza.
Great.
And it read, dogs in Sumerian bars only want to open one thing and it's disgusting. I was very, very confused because it had a lot of likes and a lot of retweets.
And you're like, I missed 1 hour of Twitter. What happened?
Yeah. And obviously I had to know what it meant, but little did I know that it would only get more confusing from here. So the joke, which apparently Tom, you've heard, and Caroline, you know of.
I've heard the joke. Yeah.
Oh, you have heard it. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's one of the earliest examples of a bar joke. I would guess it is the earliest example of a bar joke because it, although it's always listed as one of, I can't find any evidence that there's an earlier one.
4,000's pretty.
It's possibly the only one that's existed this long. Might be a better way of describing it.
There probably are others, but this is the one that was the earliest example, right?
Yeah.
Right, right.
So the joke is a dog walked into a tavern and said, I can't see a thing. I'll open this one.
Sorry, my laugh was so loud it cut out in the microphone, obviously. Yeah. That's what happened.
Obviously.
A dog walked into a bar, said, I can't see anything. I'll open this one.
I'll open this one.
Interesting, yeah.
Obviously makes no sense, right? It obviously has no meaning to us in the 21st century. There was a lot of discussion on Twitter about what the joke could mean. And some of the things people said actually ended up being pretty accurate, but let's dive into it. So, first of all, for those who don't know, Sumer is the earliest known civilization in the historical region of southern Mesopotamia, which is what is now kind of south central Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And it emerged during the Chalcolithic and early Bronze Ages, between the 6th and 5th millennium BC. I know nothing about history.
Couldn't say. Wasn't there.
This really became a huge rabbit hole for me. Sumer is one of the first civilizations in the world, along with ancient Egypt and ancient China. And the joke in question was originally found on a tablet from a group of 29 reconstructed tablets excavated between the 1880s and 1930s at ancient Sumerian cities.
Oh, wow.
This is Nippur and Ur, which are now in southeastern Iraq, and Susa, which is now southwest of Iran. And just as a point of interest, Susa is considered one of the oldest world human settlements with a history of more than 6,000 years.
Wow.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. God, we're going so... It's really just so boggling, like, how far back we're going.
And then were still making bar jokes.
Yeah, like, basically the same layout of the joke has continued all of this time.
Did the tablet mark how many likes and retweets this joke got? I wonder how funny it was. I'm not sure.
So the tablet's dating from the early Old Babylonian Empire. So 1894 to 1800 BC, so about 4,000 years ago. So I have an image of one of the tablets, which I'm going to send to you guys, and this will be in the show notes.
Oh, now it's hilarious. I get it now. It's a visual. Right? You have to see it to get it.
Really?
I'm joking. I'm joking.
This.
It's a tablet.
It's a tablet with etchings on. Right. That's what it is. So the Sumerian language is one of the earliest known written languages. It's logographic, which means a character or symbol that represents a word or a phrase. So, for example...
It looks like it's just, like, covered.
Yeah, Chinese writing is also logographic for reference.
Okay, cool.
Symbols were generalized using a wedge-shaped stylus to impress the shapes into wet clay, and this is known as cuneiform.
Mm.
So the translation of these tablets was first published in the modern day in the Journal of Cuneiform Studies in a 1958 paper called Sumerian Animal Proverbs and Fables, Collection 5.
Ah.
So, not a joke, perhaps, but a proverb.
Ah.
Oh.
So, the collection contains 125 proverbs pertaining to animals. The author, Edmund L. Gordon, categorizes them into many categories. Maxims, which are a pithy phrase like the bigger the better and good things come in small packages. Truisms, which are obviously true statements like some things ever change or you get what you pay for. Adages, which are general truths like out of sight, out of mind. Apothegms, which I can't find a different from a maxim. Taunts, compliments, simple animal proverbs, and Aesopic fables, i.e. fables similar to Aesop's fables like the tortoise and the hare.
Those weren't examples from the tablets. Those are just like common examples of modern day versions of those.
This is how we can categorize them now.
Okay. I thought you were saying that those phrases
This is how the author categorizes them.
Cool.
So lots of things. It's very confusing and overlapping. It doesn't sound to me like there are any of these are particularly jokes, but that doesn't mean that they can't be funny.
Yeah.
Animals and proverbs were really common in Sumerian culture, apparently. And they were very much anthropomorphized in the way that we do it today. So this is a quote from a paper called Impious Dogs, Haughty Foxes, and Exquisite Fish.
My favorite Dr. Seuss book.
Exactly. Evaluative perception and interpretation of animals in ancient and medieval Mediterranean thought.
Oh my God.
That slaps. I love that title.
Wow.
So it says, Sumerian social animals could also take on vernacular roles of the human world. They appeared with professions, for instance. The fox was a house builder, the ox a haughty commissioner, the sheep his own shepherd. They had family roles. They had houses and friends, human manners and pastimes. They drank at taverns and parties. They used ferry boats, shoes, water lifts, and harvesting equipment.
Okay. So I'm seeing how this dog ends up talking and walking into a bar.
Yes. But in this very much in the same way that we would anthropomorphize an animal.
Right.
So I actually have some examples other than the joke from the same collection 5. Some are just single lines and some have dialogue between animals. And I've just picked out some that I really like, which you can decide if you like them too.
Oh, I'm so excited.
The dog snarls at an ox scrubbed with soap. Yep.
Period.
Of course, duh.
From so many oxen, is there no dung?
That kind of works.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah, you can interpret it however you want. Ox, you wander about in the street like a commissioner. Yep.
Classic ox, like a commissioner. My God. I'm glad someone said it. We're all thinking
Exactly. The owner of an ox is also happy at being the emissary at the city gate. Of course, that old saying.
Duh.
really losing me here.
I do like this one. Oh cow, like a cat, you walk behind the man carrying the food.
Oh, I love oh cow.
Oh cow.
Oh yeah, and it's just O, a single O.
Oh cow.
No one will give away even a barren cow for nothing. That one actually does
sound.
That one
too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. These are great. These are so good.
Make the donkey sit like this. Make it lift its shriveled penis.
Damn, we came really close to having a penis in every segment.
I know.
Maybe next time.
It's not gonna happen.
I'll work harder next time for you folks, don't worry.
When the lion caught a wild boar, he roared, "Your flesh has not yet filled my mouth, but your squeals have deafened my ears."
Whoa! That's brutal!
I know, right? No one walks for a second time at the place where a lion has eaten a man. That one's pretty good.
I mean, that's
good.
Works as well, yeah.
That one's good.
This next one I love because it shows that the way we anthropomorphize certain animals still aligned with the way they did then.
Wow.
Nine wolves have caught 10 sheep. There was one too many and they did not know how to share out the portions. A fox came along and said, "Let me allocate the portions for you. The nine of you take one sheep. I by myself shall take nine. This shall be my share."
That's amazing.
Oh my goodness.
That's, wow. Wow.
There's a lot about dogs. Mm-hmm. Like a man's bitch, you're walking behind a shaven-headed man. I don't know. I really don't understand that one.
Nope.
And the dog gnawing on a bone says to his anus, "This is going to hurt you."
Oh my goodness.
Was that from our Hot Ones recording that we did?
Oh geez, you can see our Hot Ones recording soon on our Patreon.
Soon on our Patreon.
It's good content. Support us on Patreon.
It's good content.
So if you want to see any more of these, you can see them on the Electronic Text Corpus of Sumerian Literature, which is apparently the preeminent academic source for Sumerian literature online from the University of Oxford.
Amazing.
But with those examples, let's go back to our joke.
Okay.
And trying to find out what it means. So just a reminder, a dog entered a tavern and said, "I can't see a thing. I'll open this one." Gordon, the author of that paper from 1958, interprets this joke as the dog, having entered an inn, did not see anything. And so he said, "Shall I open this door?" That's how he translated the text.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So he says that an inn also serves in those times as a brothel, and explains that the dog wanted to see what was going on behind closed doors. You know, kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Okay. On a thread on the subreddit Ask Historians, user CoinLingua explains all of this and also adds that they found another reference in the Journal of Orientalium discussing a different Sumerian proverb. That they say this version of open, used in the proverb, is also found in another proverb thought to have sexual overtones. So kind of backing up this idea. So is this a sexual joke about a dog trying to sneak a peek in a brothel?
It also makes sense with like the anthropomorphism of like a dog. Mm-hmm. It does.
Yeah,
it means more like a character.
I think that's the conclusion quite a lot of people on Twitter seem to have come to.
Yeah.
And perhaps from this source. And it does explain that original tweet I saw, which was Sumerian dogs in taverns only want one thing. And it's disgusting.
I just think it's so interesting, though, that, like, this joke has been lost through translation. And then we have tweets, which could also just mean fuck all if you don't know the context of it.
Oh my god, that's such a good point.
Yeah.
I was going to say that you got lost on a confusing Twitter joke repeating a lost and confusing old Sumerian joke.
Yeah.
How wonderful is that?
Of course, we hear that first Twitter joke and we know the reference it is about, but someone might see that and absolutely have no clue. So that's so funny. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, history, eh?
In the same way their jokes are based on context that can get lost, ours are also on the context of
comedy.
Wild.
Comedy.
So user Serenan on the same Ask Historians thread actually thinks otherwise to the sexual reference. So they claim to be a Sumerologist. I can't obviously tell for sure without them giving their credentials, but looking through their user history, they do seem to know a lot of stuff and they do reference it. So I feel like what they're saying has some weight. So they say, I wouldn't put too much weight on Gordon's analysis, simply because it's a very old article and our understanding of Sumerian has improved significantly, especially since the 1970s. So personally, I prefer the more kind of modern translations.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like this idea because it's just how research works in general, you know?
Yeah.
Everyone's on Twitter who's taken this as a, like, this is the be and end all of this idea. Actually, research does progress very, you know, a lot, especially over the last 50 to 100 years. So Serenan, the user, says that the word eshtam, which means tavern, can be associated with prostitution, but it's not primarily a brothel. They eat and drink there too. So it could be sexual, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. Hmm. They also say that the this from I'll open this one can be read as I, as in this I. So they and the user before thought that the joke could be that the dog just his eyes closed and needs to open them to see.
That's genuinely funny. That's pretty funny.
I don't know if it's necessarily funny, but it could be actually a proverb in that case about going in blind to something.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense, like, given the context of how it was found. Yeah.
Yeah.
It reads more like a dumb dad joke also, kind of
it kind of does. Yeah.
But ultimately, the user says this. The problem with these proverbs, some of them were likely jokes, some just proverbs, is that they are attested in proverb collections with absolutely no context. So very often, we don't really understand what they're about or what the punchline is, if there was any. An added problem is that most of the extant manuscripts date back to the old Babylonian period, when Sumerian had already died out as a spoken language. In fact, these proverbs were used in the education of scribes to teach them Sumerian. So there's a good chance that some of the punchlines had already been lost in translation by this point. And they also say the problem with jokes is really they're so culture specific. Maybe this joke made fun of a local politician, or it's using a very crude word that is not otherwise in our sources. Bottom line, we don't get the joke. I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
So regardless of what other people think the joke might be about, there is every chance that a dog walked into a tavern and said, I can't see a thing, I'll open this one, is completely lost to time.
Mm-hmm.
But I love to see the interpretations of the people on Twitter.
Yeah, it's really so beautiful. Wonderful.
But there was one proverb in this list of proverbs that is truly amazing and withstands the test of time that I haven't read out to yet. This is Proverb 5.81, and it says, the dog understands take it, but it does not understand put it down.
No! That's so good!
That's a really good one.
How amazing is that?
So, any plugs or shout-outs?
I do have a quick little shout-out to someone who wrote a real kind review on Apple Podcasts.
It's Review Corner!
Do-do-do! Apple Podcasts has reviews if you want to leave one for us there. We may read it one day. This one's from Storm Patil 465, and they go, makes me feel like a kid again. When I was younger, I was really into popular science and would spend hours memorizing random facts that one might consider useless. As I got older, I grew out of this habit because life simply got in the way and I only had the time to study things that were relevant in my schooling and career. LLE brings me back to a time where I could find joy in discovery and learn for the sake of learning. Tom Lum, Carolyn Roper, and Ella Hubber are well-spoken and engaging, all-around fantastic hosts. I would recommend this podcast to anyone and everyone.
Thank you so much, Storm. That's
that
wonderful.
Makes me want to cry, this one. Like, it's so true that you just stop learning for the sake of learning when you get older.
Yeah.
You just stop learning for fun, right? Yeah.
And even though, like, because we don't do this professionally, so this podcast is that for us, which it gives us that great opportunity. So I'm so glad that other people are getting that too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Aww.
And they gave us 1 star. otherwise, I'm just Tom Lum person everywhere.
I'm Ella Hubber on Twitter for the more research and science side, and I am Big Science Energy on TikTok, and that's it.
And I'm just Caroline the Bug everywhere.
Woo!
So this episode we learnt about the amphibian apocalypse and the hope of the Golden Toad's return. We learnt that Americans need to stop putting their gosh darn flag on the moon. Stop it. And we also learnt about possibly the oldest joke we have. Might not even be a joke at all. but still really cool. And join us next time where we will learn about everything.
Let's Learn Everything is independently produced and hosted by Ella Hubber, Tom Lunn, and Caroline Roper. Editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lunn.
Join us next time where we will learn about everything.
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 Everything. Woo. Some things. Oh, no, everything. Everything. Okay.
Yeah, maybe, just a few. Just one. You could just fade
maybe
us
just
out.
One more.
You could just fade us out talking in the background.
Yeah.
Everything. 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 Okay.
Good stuff.